Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the best podcast in the world for keeping up with the news, but it's for people who don't necessarily claim to be politics know-it-alls. So if you don't know everything about politics, fine. You will absolutely follow everything I'm saying in this episode and in every episode of this podcast. And to be honest, this is just in my experience, the people who shout the loudest with their political opinions tend to know the least. That's just in my experience. But I'm going to straighten everything out for you today. I'm Julia Bell, and I want to talk to you about Matt Hancock, the UK's health secretary. And we're going to focus on this court ruling that has massively bitten him in the arse. So we're going to talk about what that was and how it came about. Now, listen, if there is a pandemic like the one that we have all been unfortunate enough to see this last year, you don't want to be the health secretary. That's the job you don't want, because all of the health-related needs of the UK are essentially your responsibility. So do we have enough personal protective equipment, PPE? Do we have enough ventilators, doctors, nurses, vaccines? All of it, really, comes under you. So none of us envy Matt Hancock's job, but as this last year has rolled on, a lot of people have stepped forward and said, do you know what? I could have done this better. This has not been good enough. Especially when people look back at the start of this whole thing and they remember that the real crisis we had with lacking PPE, you know, nurses literally wearing bin bags because they didn't have protective aprons, doctors sharing face masks because we didn't have enough. I mean, that has haunted Matt Hancock this entire time. Granted, lately, he's enjoyed some glory because the vaccine rollout has been massively successful comparatively. You know, compared to other countries, we were quicker approving the vaccines, we were quicker buying them, you know, we were higher up the waiting lists. And then in terms of the logistics of actually rolling them out and getting them in people's arms, we've broken records. And as I'm recording this now, just under 18 million people have had at least one dose across the UK. So Matt Hancock has very much enjoyed that glory, very much enjoyed it. We've all seen that video of when he kind of wept on, was it Good Morning Britain? When he just started weeping and saying how happy he was about his own work. But journalists aren't letting go, in fact, the public as well, we're not letting go of the fact that the PPE shortage happened. That's not going away just because this vaccine thing is going well, especially now, since on the 19th of February, a high court ruled that Hancock had acted unlawfully with regards to this PPE thing. Specifically, they're saying he failed to publish details of the PPE contracts in the right time frame. So this podcast is titled, Did Matt Hancock Break the Law? The answer is yes, he did, because there is a timeline in which ministers are meant to hand over all of their paperwork, which outlines the details of these deals. And because these are worth hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of pounds. So it should be public knowledge to some degree. And Hancock just didn't stick to it. So he has 100% broken the law. He's acted unlawfully. But the question is, why did he break the law in this respect? And more importantly, in my opinion, why is he outright refusing to apologise? He really is refusing. He's quick to weep and congratulate himself when things go well. But if things go wrong, my God, he really won't say sorry. And I'll play you some kind of audacious clips of Matt Hancock when we get into the episode. So I'll get you caught up on it all. I'll answer lots of your questions that have been sent in on social media. If you want to get involved in that and you want to send me questions for future episodes, you can do. Just follow me on Instagram and Twitter. The handle is @JuliaBell_X. And yeah, let's talk about Hancock and his law-breaking ways. Okay, so what exactly was this court case and how did it come about? Well, I said before that it was Matt Hancock's responsibility to get the PPE that our frontline staff needed as quickly and as cost-effectively as possible. There's a whole debate out there about why did we not have a stash of this already? Because politicians have been warned by experts of the risks of a viral pandemic for decades. So that's one debate that we'll shelve for another time. Why did we not have this stuff kind of in a vault already? But it seemed that every government across the world effectively had this issue, because in spring last year, it was a scramble, an international scramble, to get a hold of PPE. Everyone was desperate for it. So medical grade face masks and aprons, these things were gold dust. So yeah, it was a crisis situation, but that doesn't mean that Hancock and his team were completely devoid of scrutiny. It doesn't mean that we all turn a blind eye because it's a crisis and they can do whatever they want. You still have to look at what they're doing and go, hang on, have you been doing a good job of this? Because we're talking contracts worth billions of taxpayer pounds. So have you been giving this business to the right people? Have you been spending our money responsibly? Because heaven forbid there's a conflict of interest, or heaven forbid you're caught buying products that are inferior and wasting taxpayer money. Or even worse than all of that, what if you're giving business to your mates and they're skimming massive profits off the top? In those events, you are falling short of your job. So just because it's a crisis doesn't mean we can't scrutinise. And in fact, there's more need than ever to do so. So in the spirit of that, it is actually already a law that if the government spends more than £120,000 on any contract for anything that is public, so a public good or a public service, such as PPE, that's public goods, then they have to, by law, publish details of that contract, make them publicly public knowledge. So things like who won the contract, what's the company, how much was it worth, what were the products, who was involved in the transaction, that sort of stuff should be accessible for us to see. It's called contract award notice. It's a law that he has to publish it. And not only that, he has to do it within 30 days of the award of the contract. And lo and behold, spoiler alert, Health Secretary Matt Hancock did not manage it. So he awarded these massive contracts, literally worth billions, and he didn't publish the details of them within the 30-day limit by law. So it's a transparency problem, right? So the court case wasn't about the contracts themselves, although, my God, is that a different conversation? It was about how quickly did you make the details of these contracts public knowledge? And this group called the Good Law Project, which was headed up by a bunch of MPs, all who have considerable disdain for Matt Hancock, including the Green Party MP, Caroline Lucas. I think she's the only Green Party MP in Parliament. So she and a couple of other MPs clubbed together with the Good Law Project, and they launched a judicial review against Matt Hancock and his department, the Department of Health and Social Care. And this was under the bracket of, you need to be transparent. You're breaking the law because you're not being transparent. You're spending all of our money, and we need to see who's getting it. Whose bank account is this money going into? Where are we getting this PPE from? And then, as I said in the intro, the High Court ruled that Matt Hancock had acted unlawfully by failing to publish the details of these contracts within the legal time bracket. So he did eventually publish them. That's not the point. He did actually do it. But it was weeks, if not months, late for some of these deals. And the fact that the law tells you that you have to publish details of anything that's over 120 grand... and some of these were worth tens of millions. So you'd think the urgency to publish the details would be higher for the higher value contracts, but that just was not the case here. And after this High Court ruling, Hancock went on the Andrew Marr show. And I thought, on the BBC, it's kind of where politicians go to get a spanking. It's usually kind of tense. Andrew Marr gives people quite a hard time. And I thought he was going to apologise. I thought that was going to be his platform to apologise because he broke the law. Whoopsie daisy, didn't mean it. Sorry, it's a crisis and times are hard. That's what I was expecting him to say. But that interview went so differently from what I expected. I'll play you quite a substantial clip from it because it was kind of mind blowing.
Matt Hancock, we were just discussing the High Court case that you have lost. You have broken the law. Can I ask you about that? The High Court has ruled that you acted unlawfully by not publishing contracts quickly enough that your department struck during the coronavirus pandemic. And these are contracts that were worth millions and millions of pounds, sometimes hundreds of millions of pounds. Would you like to take this opportunity to apologise to people for that?
It's really clear what this court case is and isn't about. The court case did not find that there was a problem with any of the contracts. What it found is that whilst, of course, contracts like this need to be published, and we publish all of the details that are required, you're supposed to do that within 30 days. And on average, in the height of the pandemic, we did that within 47 days. So we were just over a fortnight late on average with this publication. And the reason for that is because my team were working 7 days a week, often 18 hours a day, to get hold of the equipment that was saving lives.
So that was Matt Hancock on Andrew Marr on the BBC, and you heard no apology. It was a clip void of apology and definitely no admission of guilt at all. His line was way more along the lines of, we did the right thing by not publishing this paperwork because we were in the height of a crisis. And if I were to go back, I would do it all the same again. And he's stuck to that line. Matt Hancock has stuck to that line this entire time. No apology has been uttered from the lips of Matt Hancock. It's quite extraordinary. He's broken the law within his position. And it's not just any law. It's a law about transparency when it comes to billions of pounds worth of taxpayer money. You can decide how you feel about that. Maybe I'm being too harsh, but it does seem that people across the political spectrum think that he is being stubborn about this. You can say sorry and give your reasons why you made the mistake, rather than the line that Matt Hancock is taking, which is, I have done an excellent job this entire time. And in fact, he took it a step further in his interview with Piers Morgan. He said, not only am I not going to apologise, you should be thanking me. Listen to this.
Why do you sound so exasperated? You've just been caught breaking the law.
Well, I sound exasperated for two reasons, Piers. One, because I think we should be on this programme thanking my team. You know, they worked
really?
So hard.
Really?
And
just analyse that, shall we?
Reason,
we have
the second
we have
reason is,
your team, I'm sorry, if you want to play that game with us, your team,
and the second reason
you and your team have presided over a woeful handling of this pandemic that has led to us having the worst death toll in Europe, 130,000 people dead. So I'm sorry if my first thought when you come on, Health Secretary, is not to thank you and your team for your brilliant handling of the pandemic, because I don't think 130,000 deaths shows that you've handled it well. And I'm sorry I'm not thanking you and applauding you.
Well, so the second reason that I'm exasperated and answer in this way is because as soon as I start answering a question, you cut in and just said, when I said, can I ask the question? You said, no. I mean, what's the point in coming on
because
if you're not
you
going
say
to
there was
to
no
ask
national
the question?
I mean, that, to be honest, that Piers Morgan interview was more gobsmacking than the Andrew Marr one, because listening to the health secretary say, you ought to be thanking my team, when the context of his interview is that a court has ruled that he's broken the law. That's the reason he's on telly and he's sitting there saying, you owe me a thank you. It was TV gold, but it wasn't necessarily a wise move on Hancock's part. And this is the thing. Nobody's taking away from his team that they worked hard. I'm absolutely sure that they did. No part of me doubts that there's a team of people who are all sweating under Matt Hancock's jurisdiction. But gosh, I outlined it before. The job of that office is to provide what the NHS needs to succeed. And it's to do so in the most cost-effective, the most ethical, the most transparent way. Have they done that? No. They have categorically failed to do that, and a high court has ruled that that's the case. So demanding thanks instead of just apologising and then going on to say, look, my team have been working really hard, but we're really sorry we dropped the ball there. That's what I was expecting, and my God, did we not get it. So that was the High Court ruling, and that was the context around it. I've had lots of questions about this from you guys. Most of them are in quite an angry tone. So Susan on Instagram said, is there a motive behind deliberately delaying publishing this info, or was it just a mistake? I mean, we've heard Matt Hancock's line on this, which is, we were in a crisis and we simply didn't have time to fill out paperwork. That was not our priority. He said the same thing on Marr, on Sky News, on Good Morning Britain. But, Susan, you know, this idea of, was there a motive behind deliberately delaying it? The deals themselves were controversial. I touched on this earlier, but the actual deals, if you look at them, some of them are confusing, to say the least. And the one that's circulating in the press a lot at the moment, and there's actually been a lot of these kind of dodgy contracts that have popped up in the press, but the zeitgeist at the moment is this deal that Hancock's team awarded to a personal acquaintance of Matt Hancock. You might go as far as to say a friend. It's hard to know exactly what their relationship is. So this guy, his name's Alex Bourne. He used to be the landlord of Hancock's local pub. in West Suffolk. So that's how they, I suppose that's how they met and got to know each other. But Alex Bourne owns now a company called Hinpak, which usually makes food cartons. So I guess like plastic food cartons. No experience making medical products. But one of these contracts shows that Alex Bourne's company, Hinpak, got a £30 million deal making these vials, these plastic vials. You know, I don't know if you've ever been to get a COVID test. I have. You kind of you get like a plastic tube and you unscrew it and there's a swab and you put it up your nose and you put it to the back of your throat and then you pop it back in the plastic tube and screw it back up again. Those plastic tubes, that was the deal. So he's making gazillions of these things. And the person that's doing it is one of Matt Hancock's acquaintances who has never made medical goods in his life, when there are plenty of companies out there who do. So that's the question, is why did we not give this business to a company that already does this? There might be a perfectly good reason for it, right? There might be. That's not the argument. Is saying it's definitely dodgy. It is just a little bit odd. And the worst thing about this is that Alex Bourne allegedly sent Hancock a WhatsApp message, which is incredibly informal. It's very much the way that I speak to friends rather than business dealings. But he sent Matt Hancock a WhatsApp message, sort of prodding him and offering his services, saying, look, I own this company, Hinpak. We might be able to help you. And that doesn't look great either. So no wonder people are looking at the delayed publication of these contract deals and thinking, is this about being too busy to fill in the paperwork? Or is this because some of these deals were a little bit dodgy? And are your mates skimming a big profit off of this thing? That's the debate. I'm not putting that idea in your head. That is the debate that's happening now. And Hancock adamantly denies it. He says he's got nothing to do with the Alex Bourne contract. He didn't approve it. It wasn't under him. And Alex Bourne and his team of lawyers are saying, well, yes, he owns a food carton making company, but it was well within his capacity to make medical products. So don't just shame him because he knows Matt Hancock personally. He was able to do this properly. But Susan, to answer your question, yes, there's plenty of people who don't think Hancock's answer is good enough. And some of those people are suspicious that there is more to this than simply forgetting some paperwork. It's up to you. I'm not sure Matt Hancock's line on this will change. I think he'll always stand by exactly everything he's done. But plenty of inquiries and investigations are going on about these contracts. So I'm sure in some degree we will get to the bottom of how straight-laced these contracts were. I want to talk more about these interviews that Hancock did after the court ruling. Because particularly the Good Morning Britain one with Susanna Reid and Piers Morgan, Hancock veered so far away from apologising that he skewed into the territory of delusion. Because I'm sure at one point he denied there ever being a PPE shortage in this country. Listen to this.
You claimed on the Andrew Marr show that one of your justifications was that you had avoided any national shortage of PPE.
Yeah.
Well, that's just a barefaced lie, isn't it? We were chronically short of PPE. We hadn't prepared properly for this pandemic and we got caught without enough PPE. We all know that. Why are you pretending that actually back in that first wave we had enough PPE?
I'm not at all. As I said just now, there were areas where it was enormously challenging and there were areas where there were problems, but we never had a national outage of it. We were very close to that, but we didn't have a national outage of PPE.
What do you mean by a national outage? Then, because we had literally NHS staff having to use bin liners because they were seeing colleagues dying.
We never had a national outage of it because of my team and the work that they were doing.
So, Matt, I mean, maybe I misinterpreted this, but Matt Hancock said there were areas where it was, in his words, enormously challenging, but we never had a national outage of PPE. I didn't dream that. Those were his words. He said, we came very close to it, but we never had a national outage. Honestly, I'm just a bit mind blown by this guy. And when I saw it, my first thought went to my mates in the, you know, in the healthcare industry. I've got my cousin is a nurse in Glasgow and the stories she told me were fucking brutal. And then one of my dear, dear friends down in England, Seb, he is an NHS worker. He's been on the front line this entire pandemic, working in the nursing department in intensive care units and COVID-positive wards and A&E. So he has been up close and personal with people who are dying from COVID every day of his working life for a year. And he used to tell me, I mean, one time he sent me a 9-minute voice note on WhatsApp telling me about how bad this PPE thing was. And when I saw Matt Hancock's interview denying that it was ever a national problem, I was just perplexed. And I couldn't get Seb out of my head. So I had to get him on the pod to speak for himself. And our conversation was very revealing. Hello, Seb.
Hey, Julia. You all right?
Yes. How are you?
I'm okay, actually.
I was going to say, if you were going to tell me you were good, I'd be like, liar.
Yeah, I'm good.
Listen, I don't want to take up too much of your time. We've been talking a lot throughout this pandemic. And I remember during the first wave, right at the start of this whole thing, you would often share your frustrations, particularly about the lack of PPE.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
How bad was it?
It was pretty bad. But it was more like the fear of the unknown. Like, you come into work and you wouldn't know what you're going to be faced with, like, PPE-wise. And that's what, like, that's kind of what got a lot of people, like, demoralised. Sometimes you come into work and you'd be like, okay, this is it, we've got everything. You've got everything you need. You've got your little hat, you've got your face visor, you've got aprons. And then the next day, when I say face mask, I mean, like, the proper FFP3, you know. And then literally the next day, you know, you'd perhaps not have enough aprons, or you'd not have enough visors or hairnets and masks, you know. So when we used to come to work, we'd have like a little daily briefing from like Public Health England. And so one day we'd have like, yes, we've got everything. And then the next day, the message was, oh, we deem it okay to just wear a normal paper filter face masks. And it was basically because we didn't have enough of the FFP3 ones. So it wasn't like we've done research and we actually deem it okay to wear these paper masks. In fact, the real answer was, actually, you know, we don't actually have enough. So yeah, you're going to have to make do with this. That's essentially what the message was. And that left a lot of people like, well, why one day are we wearing this and the next day it's deemed okay to wear this?
Yeah.
Like it left a lot of people confused, you know, kind of like a bit let down. People feared for their health, you know, you didn't know if you were going to catch it or what was going to happen to you, because we still really didn't know the outcomes of what was happening, you know.
Back in the first wave, we just didn't know anything about this virus, and you're walking in blind to the ICU dealing with patients who are literally dying of this very disease that you don't feel protected against. That must have been terrifying.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. And no one wanted to come to work. No, like, no one, I mean, it's a duty, but no one wanted to. And you're stuck wearing this mask for all night. Well, I done night shifts, but even for the day, like, so what would do is you'd have to kind of ration your breaks or ration when you went for a drink or when you went for the toilet, because if you took off your PPE, that you'd have to bin it. And then you'd have to reuse another lot of PPE, if that makes sense. So we were kind of like rationing our own PPE. And wow. I know of experiences, and I think I said this to you about in the first wave, of people using each other's masks because they didn't have enough masks for the ward.
So you're sharing face masks?
Yeah, it's highly gross. yeah, it's not been great.
What about now? Have you got enough of what you need?
Yeah, there's enough, yeah. I mean, I can only speak for the hospital I'm at in the east of England. But yeah, we've got enough. There's no one's worried about, you know, going without. There's plenty of masks, plenty of stock, which is quite nice. That's a, you know, reassuring feeling. Although I actually brought my own mask off Amazon, so I'm okay.
Out of your own pocket, it's kind of ridiculous. Have you watched I know you have. You've watched the Matt Hancock interview with Piers Morgan.
Yes, I have, yeah.
When Matt Hancock said the thing about we all ought to thank my team, my PPE buying team, And when he said the other thing about we've never had a national shortage of PPE, what was your reaction to that?
Well, I kind of thought maybe we should set up our own little clap for him every Thursday night and see how he feels. I'm sure he'll love it, but like sarcastically.
Yeah, slow clap. We'll all stand on our front step and go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, see how patronised he feels. Sorry, what was your question?
Well, I don't know. What was your reaction when he said we've never had a national shortage of PPE? Those are his words.
There were shortages locally. There was no national shortage because of the work my team did. And I back them 100%.
Well, it was complete trash.
Yeah.
Like in the interview, he spoke about the local shortage. If there's a local shortage, then surely that infers that there's a national shortage. Yeah. Like, so what he was saying is complete rubbish, really.
Yeah. He's always saying, we had enough in the country just because we didn't have enough in certain places. And it's like...
Which is not true, yeah.
But if nurses were, and if nurses and doctors and frontline staff were going without, then we didn't have enough PPE. And I remember you telling me about a story back in the first wave of saying, I don't feel like I can go to the toilet when I'm working because it would mean I would waste PPE because I'd have to throw it away.
Yeah, that's what I mentioned, like rationed about stuff earlier, yeah.
And to then hear the health secretary say, I think people should thank us, it just didn't sit right when I'd heard
no,
you talk
absolutely.
About your job.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. We're putting ourselves in danger just to keep it, have enough like PPE. So yeah, so we'd have to ration our, because we'd have to be thinking about the staff for the next day because we didn't know when PPE was going to come in.
Jesus.
Yeah.
And you're all, I mean, God, you're all one team then. Even people you didn't work with, you were thinking, I don't want you to get COVID, so I'm going to try and do what I can to preserve the material that we have, short as it is.
Yeah.
Hancock also talked in that interview, I don't know if you heard this bit, where he said he's learned a lot of lessons between the first wave and now. As a health worker dealing with COVID patients, has this third wave been dramatically better for you in terms of your resources, the amount of staff you've had in your team, the amount of preparedness you've had for the amount of patients? Just has everything felt better?
Yes and no. So yes, because we've been fully stocked with PPE, but because this is dragged on, staff are tired, like physically, like mentally, emotionally drained.
Yeah.
And so we, there's like little 0-hour contracts that you like bank work that you can do, or agency work. And people weren't choosing to do that because they were like, oh, I've just had enough. Even though there were like enhanced pay because there wasn't enough staff, people just chose not to do it because they were choosing their own, like even I was, even choosing my own like mental health, I guess, just to be like, no, I don't want the extra money because I don't want to work in that environment sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and so we got, our hospital got busy about a week before Christmas. So like you think like maybe like the 21st. And then after Christmas, it was just crazy. Like I think we've got 60 ITU beds in our hospital, and we had about 250 or 260 something when it was really bad. And we used operating theatres, basically any space that we could. So then therefore the capacity for intensive care nurses went up. So we couldn't fill that space because we've only got a set amount of intensive care nurses. So what we'd do is we'd have to pull staff from other wards in the hospital, other departments. So we'd be working with paediatric nurses or like plastics or et cetera, like a variety of different nurses that weren't intensive care trained or that and weren't used to that sort of environment. So the stress on them, I can only just like imagine that's just insane. And then you've got your other nurses that still want to perform, still want to be okay, but in a nice way, didn't really know what they were doing as such. Obviously, you know how to care for a patient, but when it comes to intensive care, it's a lot different.
It's a different set of skills, yeah.
Yeah, a massively different set of skills. So, and even when we were putting people from different parts of the hospital, it wasn't fully staffed because obviously they can't leave their own place like unstaffed. So, yeah, I mean, I remember looking after 8 patients and there are only 4 nurses, and really intensive care should be, or normally, is 1-to-1. And I don't know, other nights, other places were like 1 nurse to 4 or 5 intensive care patients. And to know that you're going to be faced with that the next night, and maybe you've got 3 or 4 nights of this, or 3 or 4 long days. Well, every shift, you know what I mean? To come in for that, it's not, you don't want that. Like, that's fine if you're for a little bit, but like prolonged and not knowing when this is going to end, that's kind of the worst thing as well.
So when Matt Hancock says, you know, we've learned so many important lessons and now we're in a completely different place to where we were before, you'd say yes in terms of PPE, but actually,
well, isn't that just like a rubbish apology?
He definitely did not apologise.
No, but isn't that just saying, like, that's just like weeding out, oh, yeah, well, we've learned lessons, which is essentially like, yeah, we were rubbish in the beginning.
Yeah, and the people that had to take the brunt of those lessons were in the hospital.
Yeah, pretty much.
Do you trust wholly the PPE that you have now? When you put on everything that you're given at work, do you feel, I feel safe? I feel like everything that can be done to protect me against this disease is being done on my body.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Can I ask you, I didn't plan to ask this, but if somebody said to you, I want to join the NHS and become a nurse, what would you say, having been through this year?
Go for it.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's a part of nursing. It's a part of hospital care, isn't it? When you want to care for someone, or you want to become a nurse or a doctor, you don't know what situation you're going to face. You just know you want help.
Yeah.
So if they have that wanting or desire to help people, go for it. Like, it's not fun and the pay's rubbish.
You wouldn't say, run! Run!
A part of me goes, why do you want to do that?
Apply to be on Love Island and live your best life.
Exactly. Go for it.
But on the plus side, Boris Johnson spent a lot of time clapping for you. So that must completely eradicate all the problems you've ever had.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I feel so dignified and, like, so grateful for that clap.
All right, love. Have a good night.
I will. Catch up with you soon.
Bye, hero. Yeah.
Clap, bitch. Clap. All right, bye.
Bye. So that was lovely Seb, who, like I say, he's been working back-to-back nights in ICUs and COVID-positive wards in an NHS hospital in the east of England. And I called him a hero at the end. I just did that because he hates it. He absolutely hates it if you call him a hero, because he's very modest and he just sees this as his job. Like, keep calm, carry on, get on with it. And all the clapping and the hero stuff made him a bit uncomfortable, bless him, because he just... I mean, I remember him talking to me about, I just want the government, I don't want them to clap. I just want them to get us enough staff and enough PPE. I really don't want them to clap if they're still going to fail in keeping me safe. So I kind of like winding him up and calling him a hero. But after everything he's told me, and especially after that conversation, I'm going to go with his perspective on the PPE shortage in this country rather than Matt Hancock's description, frankly. And as you can imagine, health workers across the country are recoiling from Hancock's claims about there being no national shortage. One statement that really hit home was from Dolan Bagawati from the Doctors Association UK. And he said that Hancock's comment about there never being a national shortage was disgustingly disrespectful to the memory of frontline colleagues who died from COVID-19 while raising concerns about inadequate PPE. And then he said, and this is, oh, he said, this callous disregard for the experience of shell-shocked NHS staff in order to save political face is beneath contemptible. Wow. A couple more questions from you guys then before I finish off. Alice on Instagram said, why doesn't breaking the law mean that Matt Hancock automatically loses his job? It's a really good question. And Alice, I have a feeling you're not going to love the answer, because if this set of politicians that we've got in charge now, if they lost their jobs every time they broke the law, we would have a very empty cabinet because Priti Patel, let's start with her, the Home Secretary, she technically broke the law when she was found to be bullying her staff. Do you remember when there was an independent investigation to look into her conduct with her staff at the Home Office and they found her to be bullying them? They said she might not have meant it, but she was. That's breaking the ministerial code because it says in the code that you're not to bully anybody. So she technically broke the ministerial code, technically broke the law. She did not lose her job. Boris Johnson said, we ought to form a square around the Pritster. That was his quote that he sent to kind of Tory MPs within that circle. Boris Johnson himself, I should have started with him. He didn't have a High Court rule that he'd broken the law. He had the Supreme Court rule that he'd broken the law. Do you remember when he prorogued Parliament in 2019? He'd only really just got the job of Prime Minister, and he was breaking rules left, right and centre, and he prorogued Parliament, and it was right in the midst of the Brexit mess. And the MPs were absolutely furious because they wanted to be sitting in session and debating with each other about what Boris Johnson was doing re Brexit. And he prorogued Parliament, so it meant that he sent everybody home. I remember at the time the Speaker, John Bercow, was absolutely fizzing, like inconsolable. And yeah, the Supreme Court ruled that Boris Johnson, you've broken the law. You shouldn't have prorogued Parliament at that time. So all the MPs had to come back into session and carry on. But Boris Johnson did not lose his job. Lots of people called for him to lose his job, but he stayed put. And he didn't apologise. He didn't acknowledge it. He just moved on. And it's not just the Tories. I know today is definitely a slightly aggressive episode, but that, you know me, that's not what this is about. The Labour Party, my God, they've been found to break the law when they were found to have failed to address anti-Semitism within the party. That's a party-wide issue. And they, you know, the Labour Party didn't disband. So it is a cruel, twisted logic that a high court or a very prestigious, you know, watchdog or judicial body can decide that a politician has broken the law. But it's really up to the politician themselves whether they resign or even apologise. These days, we'd be lucky to even get an apology from any of these people. And I think the approach, and perhaps this is a trickle down from sort of the Donald Trump era, the approach is very much, if you don't apologise for it, then it's still up for debate whether it was wrong in the first place. So if you adamantly stick to what you've done, then you're always going to have a swathe of the population who think, oh, maybe you didn't do anything wrong. Not sure it's the healthiest approach for elected democratic officials to take when addressing their electorate, but that is where we are, it seems. Another question. Bailey on Instagram said, I wish more people would talk about the difference between unlawful and illegal. Do you? I don't know if I wish that. It sounds like a relatively dry debate. Maybe that's a podcast for another time. Slow news week. I think I understand what you're saying. I think I do. You're sort of saying, yes, he broke the law, but he didn't act illegally, so he didn't do like a prison-worthy thing, which you're entitled to that opinion, absolutely. But I do think, Bailey, people are entitled to be pissed off. Maybe I've read your question wrong and maybe you agree with me, but I think people are entitled to be pissed off by this because this court case, it didn't even have to go as far as it did. The government could have just admitted that they'd breached the law and then it wouldn't have gone to a judicial review. But because they kept fighting, they ended up racking up a big legal fee, £200,000 apparently, of taxpayer money. So just like this not apologising thing isn't about politicians being stubborn when they break the law. It's about costing us money and wasting our time as well as refusing to be transparent. Actually, that cropped up in the Andrew Marr interview as well. He asked him about this and, as you can imagine, no apology in sight.
My question is, if you think that the judge was right, if you think this is really just a technical issue, why did you spend £200,000 of public money fighting the case in the first place? Wasting that money.
I don't think that there's been any of that. We do have
to... Well, money's been wasted.
Well, if you ask why people have raised a case like this on this matter... Perfectly reasonable question to ask. But of course, the government has to defend its position, because what we did was we did what was right, which was to buy life-saving equipment as fast as we possibly could.
So there you go. We let this court case escalate because the government had to defend itself. That's what he said. So, Bailey, I get your point. I think I get your point where you're saying, oh, come on, he didn't illegally swindle us all. He just acted unlawfully and then rectified it. But spending 200k of taxpayer money defending yourself rather than just turning around and going, whoops, these are our reasons, but we'll do better next time. It doesn't sit the right way with a lot of folks, and I do understand that, to be honest. But let me know what you think. I try and approach things with an even mindset, but I'm just not able to get over the fact that when asked for an apology for failing to keep up with laws of transparency, which are very important in a democracy, Hancock goes as far as to ask for thanks. I just can't believe that. What world are we in? It just feels quite Trumpian. But you tell me, maybe I'm being unfair. You know, we were literally in a crisis. We didn't have enough PPE and he had to do everything he could to get hold of it. He missed some paperwork by a couple of weeks. Maybe it's not so bad. I would love to hear your point of view on this. Contact me on Instagram and Twitter at @JuliaBell_X. Be nice. I'm already anticipating lots of people saying, you're biased, I'm going to unfollow you. But just please be nice. And please, if you found this podcast helpful, check out my Patreon page, because without it, I can't keep this podcast going. So please do become a patron. Buy me a coffee. It's all it is. If you saw me in the street, would you buy me a coffee for helping you out with this politics stuff? If so, do it virtually, become a patron, and on there you get access to lots of exclusive content. So opinion pieces, interviews, personal updates, all the rest of it. I keep forgetting to do a recommendation of the week, so I'm going to do that today, and I'm going to tell you to follow the Twitter account @MarsPersevere. @MarsPersevere. So that's the Twitter account of the rover that's landed on Mars. It's just cool because this Twitter account is kind of in the first person. So it's as if this rover is zooming around on Mars and updating, you know, it's posting pictures and videos and it's telling you what things are like up there. And it's talking about the consistency of the rocks and what it can see and what it can feel. And it just is a very exciting time to be alive. And it kind of takes your mind off some of the bleak things that are going on right now. So can't recommend that enough. Follow the Twitter account @MarsPersevere and catch up with, you know, how NASA are doing on Mars, which is a nice pick-me-up. And it's a nice reminder that humans can do anything. So we can get through this pandemic, even in the wake of health ministers that refuse to apologise for lack of transparency. Okay, I said it, I'm sorry. And that is it from me. Please subscribe to this podcast or click follow if you haven't yet. It just means you won't miss future episodes and they'll always be up for you, ready to listen to. And I want you to have an excellent week. The PM has outlined this roadmap back to reality, or back to normality. And hopefully by June, oh God, just keep everything crossed that we'll be able to have indoor pints. And pints abroad and just pints together. So keep positive. It's going to happen. And I'll speak to you in the next one. Okay. Goodbye.